exception to this. It's important that we learn the lesson of people like Derrida and Kittler, that there is no outside of media.
Why do we study piracy? What is it about piracy that's interesting? Now, a bit of background. I'm attracted to concepts, and I think most concepts
are listening to Mediatization Plus Publishing, a podcast episode recorded at the X Symposium 2017. We will hear researchers talk about communicating and writing research without depending on commercial publishing and corporate social media, and also new forms of scientific writing. What does the digitalization mean for the writing and reading?
I want to welcome Gary Hall. I'm very glad you're here, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Uh-huh. Thanks a lot. Is this working?
Yes.
It is working.
Yeah, it's working. You can all hear. All right. So, in The Masked Philosopher, which is an interview he gave with the newspaper Le Monde in 1980, Michel Foucault insists on remaining anonymous.
This is Gary Hall, professor in Media Performing Arts at Coventry University and co-founder of Open Humanity Press, this morning's keynote speaker. Here, Gary Hall will raise the question what scientific publishing can be if we leave the so-called Gutenberg galaxy. That is, if we stop taking the book and the author for granted in the communication of knowledge. James Arventakis, in his turn, will raise the question of who owns knowledge, and how different funding conditions can challenge the idea that research is, or should be, a public good.
And Foucault does so out of his nostalgia for a time when, being quite unknown, what I said had some chance of being heard. The effects of the book might land in unexpected places, he says, and form shapes that I'd never thought of. A name makes reading too easy. And this leads Foucault to suggest a game, that of the year without a name. For a year, books would be published without their authors' names. The critics would have to cope with a mass of entirely anonymous books. So what I want to do in this talk is I want to look at some of the ways we can make our own work less easy to read. And so travel, because the theme of the last 2 days was mobilising, to travel and land in unexpected places, not least by using masks of various kinds. But there's another reason that Foucault's Masked Philosopher is so interesting, I think, in the context of a workshop on publishing and mediatisation. And this concerns his remark that books, universities and learned journals are also information media. So as media and cultural studies researchers, it's important to acknowledge this fact, I think. Because as far as the majority of us are concerned, this aspect of the media, books and journal articles, it's just something we're required to be involved with as part of our professional activity. We might think critically about media in relation to cinema and television and the internet. Even the mediatization of culture in its entirety, as Andreas Pepp puts it. But we don't spend too much time reflecting on the media and media cultures we use in the creation, publication, and dissemination of our own research, let alone trying to challenge and change them. Linearly written and organized, bound and printed papered codex books and journal articles are media objects we're constantly reading and writing in order to understand media, culture, and the world.
I'd like to say, you can't treat me as a brand. I'm not a brand. I don't want to be, you know, because that's why we people use Twitter, they'll use Facebook. The idea now is you've shifted to an era where we can't just publish anymore. We're supposed to be micro entrepreneurs of ourselves. So as well as do my research, I'm supposed to tweet about I can't just tweet about my research because that's not seen as cool on Twitter. So I have to tweet about what I'm doing and what I've had for breakfast and where I'm going and that I'm doing this podcast with you. And I have to tweet all about, like, it's like I'm a mini celebrity and like a mini personality, and that way I'll get lots of hits, and then we can count how many hits I have, and then someone will judge me as how famous or how not famous I am. But I'm not, I don't want to work like that. I'm not an entrepreneur. I don't want to work in that kind of mode. I'm not, why would I want Silicon Valley and their kind of techniques to define the way that I want to operate? So I don't want to be a brand. Now, how can I do that? Can I step outside of the world? Well, no, because we've been talking about, you know, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, because someone will tag me, you will tag this, someone will take a photograph, I'll still be on there. So I can't actually just drop out of that world, but maybe I can play with it a little bit and make things a bit more difficult. And one way would be to assume different personas or different masks, so I don't have this constant unified brand. So, you know, sometimes I'm a pirate and sometimes I'm an experimenter. I don't have one consistent theory, so it's not like I just say, all I do is pirate philosophy, in the way some people say, well, all I do is media archaeology, or I'm an object-oriented philosopher, or, and then they'll kind of push that. I move around between different little brands, if you like, that I make up, stick for a little while, and then I'll drop. So it doesn't become this big, huge theory, like, you know, I've got an ontology that's going to answer every question. I don't. I'm making little kind of assertions, little minimal ethical or political events, and then moving on to somewhere else.
But as part of a political institutional system of production and control, complete with its inherited disciplinary practices and protocols of status and advancement and recognition, books and journal articles have become so naturalised and accepted a part of our professional practices that they're not something that we're either especially willing or able to devote much critical attention to. And those of us who write on mediatisation are no exception to this. Yet it's important that we learn the lesson of people like Derrida and Kittler, that there is no outside of media, and recognise that books and journal articles are media as much as films and the internet, the cloud, and any other aspect of the media cultures that mould us. So, for example, the inherently taken-for-granted arrangement by which most of us operate today is that the ideas contained in the text we write are distinct from the material forms they take as physical objects. This is usually that of a series of pages gathered together in a coherent, numbered sequence using cloth and wood and pulp-based paper, card, ink and glue, and then reproduced, distributed and marketed as a codex print document by a publisher on a mass industrial basis as a commodity that can be privately owned and bought and sold using a copyright or rights reserved license. However, as my reference to our political institutional system of production and control implies, our books and articles are not just media. They're also part of the structural conditions constituting the conditions of possibility that order and mould our ways of being and thinking and doing. And as you can see, I'm quoting here from David Theo Goldberg's The Afterlife of the Humanities, but the work of Walter Ong and Wilhelm Flusser and Bernard Stiegler should all be mentioned in this context too. That said, the most well-known and influential expressions of his idea remain Marshall McLuhan's books, The Gutenberg Galaxy and The Medium is the Message. So from this perspective, the development of the print book and the corresponding requirement for closed-off spaces in which we have time to read and study is portrayed as having played a fundamental role in the emergence of modern subjectivity, along with the associated concepts of the rational liberal individual, linear thought, and the related long-form argument, as well as critical reflection, and also the public-private distinction.
My goal is not to reach, necessarily to reach, as many pieces of pop. What I want to do is have an effect in the world, an interactor in it, in the kind of Karen Barron sense, that I'm already born out of my relationship to it. I want to kind of engage with it, and I do a series of projects that are trying to do that, but they're not necessarily about, it's not necessarily about communicating to as many people as possible, because as I was saying before, there's not already an audience out there. So partly why I got into open access is because, well, I might write a book and only two people want to read it. But maybe that's okay. Maybe those two people will be really important. Maybe people don't read it in 10 years' time, but it's still important to do that. Whereas today, most commercial publishers will say, well, unless it, you know, you're not going to have a certain amount of readership, then we're not going to publish that. And so that's basing your notion of what research should be on economics, on the number of readers you're going to have, and maybe that's not the definition of interesting research. Interesting research is, maybe we should have different criteria for judging something that's interesting. So my projects are not about attracting the most amount of readers, which is, I believe, I make the work accessible in the sense that everyone can access it, but a lot of it is very complicated, theoretical, philosophical work.
So in the case of an ink on paper book on mediatisation, this assemblage includes most obviously the author, her teachers, colleagues, students and peers, together with the book's publisher, the peer reviewers, designers, copy editors, we talked about a little bit yesterday, proofreaders, printers, distributors, retailers, purchasers and readers. But it also embraces all the other connections and lines of interaction that necessarily connect the text to its many outsides. The labour and resources used in the book's production and that of any software packages such as Microsoft Word and Adobe InDesign that's used in its composition. The minerals, metals, plants, dyes, oils, salts and pigments. The shipping, container costs and environmental impact and so on. Just as importantly, this assemblage includes the copyright licence that controls the sites through which a book can and cannot move. An aggressively tax-avoiding for-profit retailer such as Amazon, but not supposedly a so-called pirate network such as ARG or Library Genesis.
Yeah, so the question becomes, how do you then draw the connection between research and piracy theory?
James Avanitakis, professor in social and cultural analysis at West Sydney University.
Well, I mean, again, it's interesting. It's, you know, when you get, say, funded research, some funders like to see that research being open access, yeah? So you get to the position where, you know, they see it as a researcher employed by a publicly owned university and receiving money from the government. My research is a public good and should be available to everybody. Other research, for example, becomes, is commercialized. And so the people there will say that the research I produce, if they fund it, is owned by them and therefore is not a public good. It's something that's specifically owned by these other people. And somewhere in between those two extremes is the idea that as an academic, as a researcher, I publish in different environments. And one of those places I may publish may be a commercial publisher who then feels that they own the thing that the research I've released through their work. But as I said, attitudes towards property and in this stage intellectual property vary significantly. It's a different social context. So someone who sees my research as being valuable for the communal good, or they may pirate that research because they may see it as the need for the communal good outweighs the need to respect the commercial property rights that exist. So piracy in many ways highlights the tension of who owns research. Is it owned by the researcher? Is it owned by the university? Is it owned by the commercial publisher? Or is it a public good? And that question then is very much opens up these zones of uncertainty, and it's within those zones of uncertainty that piracy begins to emerge.
But it follows that for the material forms of the media technologies which with ideas are created and published and circulated change, that so do the ideas themselves, and with them human subjectivity and consciousness. And this is significant because we are currently in the process of leaving the Gutenberg galaxy of the fixed and finished book, of privacy, the rational, liberal, individual human subject skilled in critical reflection. Consider the way our notions of public and private are changing. We increasingly no longer require closed-off spaces in which to study and write print books in silence, a room of one's own, as Virginia Woolf put it. Instead, We're reading hybrid combinations of print and other media in public, on our laptops, in coffee shops, and in libraries that sound like coffee shops and look like technology startups. But we're also reading while travelling on public transport, using mobile media that track our locations and even our bodily movements, and in online social networks that encourage us to make personal information publicly available by sharing our likes and what's happening with us, and that judge and shame us if we go against social norms. But what if we are in the process of moving to a post-Gutenberg world? And there's a great new book by Beatrice Colomina and Mark Wigley called Are We Human? That kind of partly addresses this question. One of the things they focus on is the emergence of the mobile phone. I'm trying to do mobile media here. Mobile phone in 1983. And increasingly attached to us with earpieces and headsets and watches, they show how this object has become an integral part of the body and brain. There are more active cell phones on the planet than people. More people have access to cell phones than toilets. So for Colomina and Wigley, the mobile might be the single prosthetic device that's done the most to transform the human body and mind. For them, the mobile phone is usually the first thing that people touch in the morning and the last thing they touch at night. Most sleep with their phone within arm's reach, and an ever-increasing number keep it inside the bed. More than a third of people admit to answering it during sex. Make sure I don't catch anyone's eye there. It's just no longer an accessory to human life, but a new kind of life. A whole new version of our species has arrived, they proclaim. And as evidence, they point to the way the mobile phone has indeed affected our notions of public and private. Today, the highest level of public exposure happens from the most private spaces, including the bed. Thus, in Laura Poitras' film, Citizen Four, we see Edward Snowden sitting on his bed in a Hong Kong hotel, surrounded by his laptops, communicating with journalists in the room and around the world about the secret world of massive global surveillance. The biggest invasion of privacy in the history of the planet is revealed from bed. To what extent can we explore the hybrid, multimodal, what you might call Zuckerberg galaxy, by continuing to act as if we're living in that of Gutenberg, with its emphasis on writing, the fixed and finished book, privacy, and the rational liberal subject? Now, this doesn't mean we all have to now sign up to Facebook and YouTube and academia.edu so we can try to understand our post-Gutenberg world by learning to think with these corporate media environments and not just about them. But neither does it mean that we should be acting today as if we can somehow replicate the conditions of the Gutenberg galaxy, especially its quiet, private spaces where an individual could concentrate on reading and writing books without having their thoughts distributed by a constant stream of communications from the so-called outside world. So I'm thinking of Nicholas Carr moving to the mountains in Colorado, where there's no mobile phone service, so he can produce his books about how the internet is damaging our brains. Or there's Jonathan Franzen here, permanently sealing up the Ethernet port on his laptop that enables him to connect to the internet so he can write his great American novels. No matter how critical we are about the Google galaxy, we can't look nostalgically for a return to that of Gutenberg and the Codex print book. In fact, one of the main points I want to make is that when it comes to our ways of being and doing, our ways of acting, as James was talking about, these two culture industry-dominated systems for the creation and publication and dissemination of knowledge and research, what we might crudely characterise as the classic closed system of print culture and the newer semi-closed system of corporate, social and mobile media, that they're not so very different in this respect. Instead, I'm motivated more by the idea of taking some of the tendencies associated with this transition and giving them new inflections that are different to both.
What I'm interested in is the process of transition from a paper-centric world of the book, the Codex book, print book, and the journal article, and if we're making a transition to what you might crudely you're calling the digital landscape, what I'm interested in is not necessarily the destination. If we're going to all digital, what I'm interested in is the opportunity that's created by that moment of transition. Because when you have the moment of transition, it means that we can insert ourselves and change things in the direction that we want to go in, so we don't have to be led by other forces. If there's that kind of moment, that gap between one era and another era, if we can insert ourselves in that gap, then maybe we can change things in a direction politically, ethically, that we're kind of interested in.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The question, I suppose, is, yeah, what happens to research in this changing media landscape? A changing media landscape means that the research itself has to change. But it's not simple. Everything must change. I think research itself is a multidimensional thing. So I think sometimes as researchers, it's important that we research and we write for each other, because I think those kinds of conversations can be insightful. And so one audience when in this world of media is ourselves, you know, is other academics. But other important audiences is the broader public, the mainstream media. And I think in addition to being able to write research papers that may be considered dense or may be considered theoretically heavy and very philosophical, we should also be thinking about how we write papers that are highly accessible, shorter, you know, 800 words, 1,000 words, and provide different insights and how the research is important into people's lives. So, the other thing that happens to research in this area is that we need to, I think, make it as accessible as possible. And so I think open access journals or pre-release versions or proof versions should be something that becomes much more widely accessible to people. And I think we have this amazing technology available to us, and we should take advantage of it to distribute this knowledge. It's never straightforward, however. You know, the other side of this is that we have traditional structures that really do reward academics for publishing in established, closed, paper-based journals. You know, and we must acknowledge that a lot of academics publish in those areas, and so fight against this. And there's nothing wrong with that. I just think that both those two streams or the many different streams of publishing in this changing environment need to be considered.
I'm just going to quickly end, though, with what's our latest project, which hopefully is due to be launched shortly at my university, Coventry. And that's going to be a way of disrupting our current Centre for Disruptive Media. I thought it was appropriate to disrupt ourselves. So. And so this new project is an international research centre that the university doesn't know, but you're the first guys to hear, or publicly, that externally we're going to call it the Post Office. And the idea for it comes very much from Foucault's Masque Philosopher interview. As the Post Office is going to engage with and create not so much mass media as masked media of my title. And the first mask is that of the name itself, the Post Office. As we know, email and blogs and social media such as LinkedIn and Academia.edu and ResearchGate are contributing to a process of neoliberal academic subjectivation, in which we act as highly visible entrepreneurs of ourselves and our work through the adoption of self-presentation techniques originating in the culture of Silicon Valley. So micro-celebrity, we've all got a tweet about our breakfast like anyone's interested, self-quantification, self-promotion, all that kind of stuff. It's a process of self-forming that can be linked to what Roger Burroughs calls the metrization of the academy. The media temptation is to react to this situation by staying offline and not using the likes of Facebook, Twitter or WhatsApp at all. However, as we've seen, it's not clear to what extent privacy from these networks is still possible in the post-Snowden era. We're all on Facebook and Twitter, whether we signed up to them or not. So with the Post Office, we're going to be masking ourselves by hiding in plain sight. Not by putting something over our faces, although I quite fancy doing that for their website, but by choosing a name that does a similar job as the Guy Fawkes masks do for Anonymous. You've got to be thinking, where do you hide a leaf? In a forest. So we've deliberately chosen a name that's the antithesis of individualistic micro-celebrity, in that it represents a public institution rather than a privatised utility. The post office is a form of communication that brings people together and helps form a community. It's also a name that's distinctly unglamorous. I don't know about your university, my university is always like, you know, future change and all these kind of entrepreneurial things. But most importantly, the post office can't easily be found online and thus used in self-quantification, self-promotion or in branding, since the post office is already a brand. If you search for Coventry post office, we will come way down in the Google. So I realise all this may seem a little odd and it might seem a little bit counterintuitive at first, but for us, these are precisely the kind of things we think we need to do if we are to make our own work land in unexpected places and form shapes that we'd never thought of, as Foucault says. Thank you very much for coming so early and for listening. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.